Welcome back. Glad to have you along tonight, hour number two. We have two very special guests this hour and two special guests the next hour as well. Noe Torres is back tonight. He, of course, with Ruben Uriarte, wrote the book, The Ultimate Guide to the Roswell UFO Crash. It's quite a book. We've had them both on before. They were kind enough to bring a very famous gentleman on who has created quite a stir since he was on. Let's say hello to Noe first and bring him back on. How are you?
Good evening, Jeff. I'm so happy to be back on your show again. I appreciate you inviting me tonight, and I'm so looking forward to discussing the infamous Roswell UFO crash tonight with you.
We will. And how is Colonel Willingham? I just want to toss that out there.
Colonel Willingham is doing well. He has been settling into his summer routine. He goes to various family reunions, and he celebrates a birthday in August. So are kind of gearing down for the summer, and he's enjoying himself there in his hometown near Wichita Falls, Texas.
Very good. All right, the book itself, The Roswell UFO Crash, The Ultimate Guide, written by Noe Torres. I guess Ruben isn't a co-author on this book with you. This is your own effort.
Well, Ruben had some other projects that he was working on, but he certainly collaborated with me on the writing of this book, as we have written a number of UFO-related books and have several projects that we've worked on together. So he was a big factor in this book, although he wasn't listed, credited as an author. He
right.
was behind the scenes, a very important influence and a very important inspiration to me.
Right.
As was the person who's going to be a guest, a secret guest for you here in a little bit.
Well, we're going to bring this gentleman on right away, because he is such an historic figure in the entire Roswell UFO crash or crashes. There's a lot of arguing going on still about how many events there were. One, two, no one knows for sure, but at least one. We do know that. Our very special guest tonight is the man who wrote the foreword to your book, The Ultimate Guide to the Roswell UFO Crash, Dr. Jesse Colonel Marcel Jr. Are you there, Colonel?
Yes, sir, I am. Right here.
Welcome back. It's been a number of years since you were on, and I think it was before you went to serve again in Iraq, if my memory is correct. You were called up, or you volunteered and went back over there to help.
Well, they kind of called me back in,
Yeah.
They asked me if I could serve. I said, sure. So if I could pass the flight physical, they said, you're going. So I did, and they did. So.
Wow.
But we got back okay, though.
Well, that's wonderful, and it's quite a situation. In the first hour tonight, we had a gentleman who is serving in Afghanistan right now. He's a National Guardsman, and he's 50 years old, and he's doing guard duty. And while he was up in his guard tower, he saw five lights in a perfect triangular formation come right up and over the mountains. He is in Nandahar, not Kandahar province. And this triangular craft, he is absolutely certain it was one piece, was so big, it came right over his guard tower, stopped right over the base, and was bigger than his entire base underneath.
Hmm.
So it was quite a story. All right, how did you get to know Noe Torres?
Well, he contacted me. We just started exchanging email and just got to know each other and worked out okay.
You continue to be, in many ways, the most important living figure in Roswell. I guess our listeners, most of whom are familiar with your story, should get just a little bit of background. You were 11 years old. Your dad came home one night. But can you give us just, I know you've done this 1,000 times, but tell our listeners, we have new young people listening all the time who don't know the story, and just give a little background, if you would, Jesse, please.
Sure. This is 1,001 times, huh? Yeah,
okay.
My dad was the Air Force intelligence officer for the Roswell Army Airfield in 1947, when he was with the 509th Bomb Group, a composite group that, as you know, dropped the two nuclear weapons zone in Japan.
Right.
Yeah, and so he had fairly high position in that thing, because as the intelligence officer, he had to know everything that was going on. And but as it turns out, there was a crash of some kind of a vehicle on a ranch outside of Roswell, on the Foster Ranch. So the rancher, got on his horse the next day and rode out and saw a lot of debris just scattered about there. The way my dad described it, it was about a half mile by long by three quarters of a mile wide. So there's a considerable amount of this debris.
Well, as base intelligence officer, I want to underscore the point that this military base was probably without equal in the world. It was the world's first nuclear-capable, nuclear-armed Army Air Force base. Later, of course, they split the services and it became the Air Force and the Army. But these are the best of the best. This is the cream of the crop.
They're all handpicked individuals because, after all, they had a very important mission in the war. And with the 509th Bomb Group, we all know how that ended. They're handpicked men for their training and their knowledge of aircraft and whatever.
Was your dad we say the first person there, the second person on the scene, the third person on the scene outside of Mac Brazel?
Well, of course, Mac Brazel was the first one, and I guess his son Bill Brazel was out there too. And I guess Mac had contacted the sheriff of Chavez County and had brought some debris in for the sheriff to see, and they didn't know what it was. So the sheriff said, "Well, why don't we just get this over to the Army Airfield there in Roswell to the 509th?" And so Colonel Blanchard, who was the base commander at the 509th, saw this debris and didn't know what the heck it was. So he dispatched my dad and a CIC agent, Sheridan Cavett, out there to go ahead and recover some of the debris and bring it back to the base so they could get a better look at this.
Mm-hmm. They take pictures of it too.
They may have. I don't know. Well, I'm sure they would have.
Mm-hmm.
But I was not on the end of the inside of that. But anyway, my dad did pick up representative portions of the debris, and I guess as did Sheridan Cavett. Yeah, my dad was in our private automobile, 42 Buick Special.
Yeah.
And Cavett was in a carry-all, an Army vehicle, and so they both went down back to Roswell after they picked the debris up. And as it turns out, our house is on the way to the airbase. So my dad, realizing that this is something very special, that he thought that my mother and myself should look at this. So what he did, even though it's about 1 o'clock in the morning by that time, he spread some debris out on the kitchen floor and woke my mother and myself up. And I thought, what the heck is he doing? He's coming back here at 1 o'clock in the morning.
So he stopped the Buick outside, came in, laid this stuff out on the floor, and woke up the family. All right.
Yep, he did. And he said, "Look at this. You'll never see anything like this again," which was true. And he was very excited. I thought that this was parts of a flying saucer or words to that effect. I myself did not realize what a flying saucer was. But at looking at the debris, I realized this was something very special and probably not anything of human manufacture.
So Dad knew immediately when he saw the pieces out in the field that this was nothing from the military.
Yeah, he was familiar with all kinds of aircraft.
Yeah, it had to be, of course.
And the accident investigation team and so forth. So he was in on the inside of all kind of military aircraft and realized this is not one of those.
Uh-huh. So you're 11 years old. You're sleepy. Did you stay sleepy for long, or did you wake right up?
His excitement caught on.
I would think.
Yeah, it got my attention, to tell you the truth. And, first thing, I remember this very... I have a voice problem, but...
You sound fine.
His first thing that he told us was, "Look at this and tell me what you think, and look for any electronic debris like vacuum tubes, resistors, condensers, or wires." But there wasn't anything like that. And he already knew, but he wanted me to satisfy my own curiosity there.
Mm. That's a good dad. That's very interesting to challenge you like that. Very smart.
He wanted to make sure, let you know what he thought.
Yeah.
And again, there's a lot of metal debris, foil-like things, and beams, metal-type beams, and the strangest thing with the beams, they had symbols along the inside surface.
No question in your mind, these were they stamped in there somehow or engraved? Do you remember anything like that?
I don't know what they were. I do realize they were imprinted on the inside surface of this, like an I-beam.
Yeah.
And I thought at first that it might have been Egyptian hieroglyphics, but there weren't anything like that. But I do recall the color. They were a very, a light violet hue, semi-reflective of light. Because I held one of the beams up over my shoulder, and the kitchen light was above my shoulder on the left side, and it would reflect back on it. But
that
I don't know if this was embossed or whatever.
That sounds pretty. So the characters themselves had a light violet hue to them.
Yeah.
Very interesting. When we come back, Jesse, I want to ask if you'd describe how big the I-beams were, what they felt like to an 11-year-old, heavy light, how long they were. Were they twisted in any way? Okay, we'll just do that in a minute. Noe, this is great. I want to thank you very much for inviting Jesse Marcel Jr. on, and obviously our thanks go to him as well. We'll be right back with more in just a minute. Okay, and let's get right back to our conversation. Jesse Marcel Jr., who at age 11 is telling us what his dad brought home around 1 a.m. from the Foster Ranch for him to take a look at. So did I hear that right, Jesse, that the characters themselves had a different color than the I-beam?
Well, yeah, the I-beam itself was like a metal, a gray gunmetal color.
Got
like aluminum, or, you know, it was not shiny or anything like that, but the
mm-hmm.
the symbols themselves were violet, purple, semi-reflective of light, and they were looked like mathematical symbols or geometric symbols, like, you know, oblate spheroids, triangles, squares, you know, any kind of combination of that, kind of imprinted on the inner edge. I don't know whether they were actually embossed or whatever, but that's what they were.
And how heavy were these I-beam pieces?
Oh.
How big were they? How long were they?
Well, the one I had was about 12 to 18 inches long and had about 3/4 of an inch in cross-sectional diameter. And it was very light. You could tell that, you know, almost like there was nothing in your hands.
Don't you wish you still had it?
If I did, if I kept a piece, I would not have it now.
I hear that. And we've had so many people over the years say the same, well, I had a piece, and they came, knocked on the door, and it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that's the way they do it.
That's exactly what happened.
They know exactly where these things are and where they go. Noe, please step in here and go ahead with a question or two.
Yes, Jeff, I was just listening to that story, just transfixed by the colonel's description of what he experienced. I remember in the early 1980s reading the very first book ever written about this, the Roswell incident by Berlitz and Moore.
Yeah.
And I remember vividly... I was just reviewing the book right before we went on the air. I still have a copy of it. I remember vividly reading the story of Colonel Marcel in the kitchen of his home there in Roswell, just looking at and handling this debris from that was very obviously not from Earth, as he says.
Right.
And that made such a profound impact on me. It caused me to have a great interest in the topic of unidentified flying objects and in the whole phenomenon over the years. And it also brought to mind something that Colonel Marcel very succinctly and very well put together in the foreword to our book, and that is he explained how... this experience that he underwent in Roswell in 1947 impacted his entire life from that point on. And he was never able to look up in the sky again the same way. And, you know, it was just a life-changing experience for him. And that's something that I'd like to ask him to elaborate on for us a little bit about.
Sure. Did you have any idea at age 11 that what you were looking at? I mean, kids at 11 don't usually think too far ahead. I mean, they're absorbed with each day. But as the years went by and you knew this story wasn't going away, I guess you kind of thought it might be part of your life for the rest of your life.
Yeah. Well, it was, you know, it was a game changer, like Noah says. And what it did for me is to make me realize that, you know, our planet is is just one planet among many that are inhabited by civilized people.
Oh, sure.
And
sure.
Obviously some of these are more advanced than we are because they get here from wherever they come from. And I'd sure like to know where they come from. But what it did, you know, it made me very interested in astronomy and cosmology because I realized that, hey, there's others out there. And the other thing it did for me, too, was, you know, I was not a real religious guy at 11 years old, but it sure did make me feel that, you know, God is really who he is. He's omnipotent, and he made more than just us.
He made a lot more than just us. My question is, it's not so much where they come from. Obviously, just our galaxy alone probably has thousands, if not tens of thousands, of inhabited planets.
Oh, you bet. It does.
Intelligent life forms of one degree or another. But why would, I guess, this is such a freak show here. I mean, if I were from another planet, I'd run tours here. You'd go watch these lunatics on this planet destroying their home, which is what we're doing. Not to mention ourselves. I mean, this is crazy.
Yeah, my feeling is, you know, we're relatively primitive compared to them. And I guess they're like scientists observing like an ant colony.
Yeah.
Is it going to destroy itself, or is it going to continue to evolve into into a more peaceful situation? And God only knows, you know, war is horrible, and I just got my fill of it in Iraq.
Well, for sure. When did your father pass? I've forgotten.
In 1986.
Yeah, yeah. He, in that, I'll never forget the picture, the look on his face, and you know exactly what I'm talking about. The look on his face really kind of told the story, didn't it?
It did. You know, when he was holding a piece of that debris in General Ramey's office, which is very obviously part of a radar target, which was not what we saw in Roswell.
Right. What did you think of the work on enhancing that, apparently, telegram that Ramey was holding, or a telex, and getting some text off of that? That was pretty amazing.
Yeah, it pretty much tells a story with that, you know, because in that memo there was words like victims of the wreck and things like that. And you know, that's the notes that it was certainly more than just a balloon or whatever they want to call it. Because, you know, there are no victims in a balloon wreck.
No, no. When you were looking at the debris on the floor in the kitchen with your dad, what is your mom saying? What are they talking about? What do you guys think?
Okay, you know, she's a housewife from the 1940s, kind of kept to herself and let the guys do all the talking and all that. But she was very interested in this too, and got down on the floor and kind of oohed and aahed with the rest of us there.
You were very, we got a break here. You were very lucky, as are all people, so-called baby boomers or shortly before. Because you lived in the best of times, and you had a real family with a real mom and a real dad, and these kids now, they just don't get it. They don't know. Yeah. They don't understand our values, our principles.
We've lost a lot.
Yes, we have. All right, back in just a couple minutes with our distinguished guests. Okay, and we are back. Jesse Marcel Jr., a medical doctor, Dr. Marcel, his father a major, Jesse a colonel. When you were a boy, did you want to be a doctor when you grew up? Was it one of those kinds of things that kids used to do? Yeah, I want to be a doctor when I grew up, and they did it?
No, I wanted to be a pilot. As a matter of fact, I had dreams of going to Pensacola Naval Aviation School in Florida and learning to be a combat pilot.
Huh. Well, all right.
But my mother kind of redirected that thought into medicine.
All right. Now, where are we in the whole Roswell history? How much progress have we made? I mean, what happened to your dad, the picture with his face telling the story? Anybody who looks at the story, even in a cursory fashion, comes away with the obvious truth that it happened. It was quite real. I mean, it's just too much. What did your dad's career as we look back on this whole story, what happened to your dad in his career after this event?
Okay. Well, you know, as you know, he flew component parts of the wreckage to General Ramey in Fort Worth to let him look at it. He was an 8th Air Force commander.
Right.
And when they realized what they had, you know, that this was something very, very critically special, my dad was given orders not to ever talk about it again. And I guess...
In the military or without or anywhere?
Anywhere.
Huh.
And so when he got back from Fort Worth, you know, they flew the wreckage under armed guard in a B-29. But when he got back from that area there, he sat my mother and myself down and said, look, you know, this didn't happen. It never, you know, don't ever talk about this again. I'm talking about it now, though. But he said, you know, just keep this to yourself. Don't ever talk about it. So I never did talk about it, even among my friends.
And it never came up again. He never obviously told any of his fellow officers or servicemen that
he
had stopped.
Well, I think there's a lot of rumors and buzz about something very special happening, but...
Such as?
But he kind of kept it close to himself.
What are the rumors about?
Well, that there was a spaceship or, you know, bodies of extraterrestrials and things like that.
Right.
And very few people were on the inside to know this, though.
Right. Did he say anything to you about bodies?
My wife asked him point blank one day, did he see the bodies? And he said, no, I did not see the bodies. But he knew they were there because he knows of people who did see them. But he himself did not personally observe this.
Did his personal life, did his disposition, did his attitude change after he... In a way, he had to take the fall for this.
Yeah, I don't know that he did. If he did, he kept it to himself.
So he pretty much was the same old dad.
Yeah, as far as I can
I'm
tell,
glad
yeah.
to hear that.
Yeah.
I'm really glad to hear that. I was always wanting to ask you that question mm-hmm. because that was a pretty damned awful thing to have to do.
Well, he was
but
a good
again,
soldier.
What's that?
He's a good soldier in his fallen.
Yeah, I was going to say, a different time, different age, different era. World War II, the ethic
yeah.
of serving your country, right or wrong, you did. You know, it was an honor
exactly.
when you were told to do something. You damn well did it. And
the
that's
Cold
been
War
a real,
ramping up. Yeah.
Yeah, that's been a real problem for Roswell investigators because a lot of these men, and there aren't too many left now, took it with them. They
yeah.
didn't ever break the vow. And
yeah.
In a way, I can understand it, but in another way, we have, in my view, and maybe you'll agree or disagree, a birthright as living, supposedly sentient beings to know officially and formally that we are not alone. Now, we all know that because we're in this business of research, but and the fact of the matter is the government continues to play this asinine cover-up game. And it's highly offensive to me, and I've just ignored it for years. I don't even go there. But don't you agree that we have a right to know and for
oh,
these
absolutely.
People to take it with them? What would you, in other words, let me rephrase this. What would you tell them, Jesse, an older man who is obviously, you know, doesn't have a lot of time left? What would you tell him about his vow of keeping this quiet? Would you tell him to just, come on, let's not take it with us. Let's
yeah.
let's share it. What would
well, you
tell
know,
him?
He didn't start talking about this till 1978, when Stanton Friedman got the word out that my dad had something to do with a flying saucer wreck in Roswell, New Mexico. So,
right.
But he kept it to himself till that time. Although I think he must have kind of intimated that he saw something very special on his ham radio. He's an avid ham radio operator.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he might have told some of his buddies about, hey, you know, we're not alone. There's other guys out there, and more than that, they've been here, and I saw it, you know. And then Stanton got word of that, so then Stanton really interviewed him and got the word out officially, so to speak.
Right. Oh, yeah. Noe, step right in here, please.
I've been wanting to ask Colonel Marcel a question. There's a very dramatic scene in the Showtime movie that was done a few years ago on the Roswell incident, in which his dad walks into a reunion of the 509th bomb group.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of confronts several of the you know, fellow servicemen that he served with back in Roswell about something strange having happened in 1947. And some of them, some of the servicemen were kind of denying that there was anything out of the ordinary. It was a very intense, very dramatic scene. I was wondering if Colonel Marcel might elaborate on, does he feel that was accurately portrayed? Did it really happen that way?
Well, you know, let me put it this way. There's a lot of poetic license in movies and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So to my knowledge, and I should have known, reunion never did happen.
Really?
Yeah, right.
It did not happen.
Did not happen. But that was just part of the story.
Well, yeah,
to make a good story better.
That is interesting. Fascinating, actually. What would you like to see happen, Jesse, if anything would break open on this? What would really be, in your opinion, beneficial to all humankind here?
Well, I think the sure knowledge that we're not alone, that there's certainly more intelligent, obviously more intelligent civilizations than us out there, and it might tend to bring us closer together. You know, like President Reagan said words to that effect in a speech at the United Nations. That,
he did.
You know, what if, you know, there are others out there, and what if they're here? You know, things like that. And that would that not make us closer? And I think they would.
Well, the whole paranoid reaction to these control freaks is that, gee, if we were able to find out about this somehow, we might not be so obedient. We might rear up and say, hey, you guys aren't the number one kids in town.
Right.
It's wild. Hold on, we'll be right back. And one or two more questions for Jesse Marcel Jr. Dr. Marcel, very graciously with us tonight. And we'll do that right after this. Okay, and we're back. Noe, go ahead, ask a question or two if you would, and then I'll come in and we'll let Jesse get some rest here.
Well, I'm just wondering how Colonel Marcel feels about all the research that's been done in the past few years by people like Don Schmidt, Tom Carey, Kevin Randall. They've been able to trace a lot of the former Roswell servicemen and have conducted extensive interviews. A lot more information has come out about what was happening at the base in July 1947, the comings and goings of the various cargo planes and so forth. How much of that, Colonel, have you been able to follow, and what's your opinion of how many witnesses have come forward in the past few years to tell their stories of some very remarkable events there?
Well, you know, I'm not a researcher. I'm just an observer. I saw what I saw, and I know there's a lot of other people who saw the same kind of material. So it's good to get interviews from all the firsthand observers. And unfortunately, I think time is kind of getting rid of a lot of us here, too. I may be one of the last ones here, but it's very valuable research to get these anecdotal experiences put together and tie it down. Now, as far as physical evidence, we don't have that yet.
Now, do you recall, Colonel, back in the late 70s when Stan Friedman first contacted your dad, did he ever tell you that he was kind of hesitant to bring the Roswell incident forward? Was there some hesitation on his part? Or once he made that decision, he and the rest of you in the Marcel family were ready to come forward with it?
Yeah. Well, you know, I was no longer at home at that time. I was living here in Montana, and so by the time Stanton got to him, I would call my dad and mom, you know, once or twice a week, whatever. But I was not there when Stanton did this.
Hmm.
So I'm not sure what the circumstances were.
Okay. We have summertime in Roswell coming up. You're going to be down there for much of the festivities, Jesse?
Yeah, I'll be there for part of it, sure.
Do you enjoy meeting people and still talking about this and shaking hands? I mean, is it getting a little tiring?
Well, yeah, I enjoy people. You know, I'm a people person.
Yeah.
So, yes, I enjoy talking with people. And, you know, I like to even talk with the skeptics and try to embellish my feelings upon them.
Uh-huh.
And say, look, It's good to be skeptical. You know, that keeps everybody honest.
Yeah, honest skepticism, yeah.
One of these days, it's all going to come out, and I hope sooner than later, because I'd like to be around when it does come out.
Yeah, it's, you know, as I say, the evidence is already like Mount Everest. I mean, we know.
It's
just this stupid media and this idiotic government agenda wanting to hide and hoard everything for itself that is keeping this pretense of us being the only game in the universe, which is beyond, the word is really asinine. I mean, it's just a dumb thing.
Yeah, I'm not sure why you really want to keep this under wraps, because in my opinion, it should not be kept under wraps.
Of course not. No, absolutely not. All right, you'll be down in Roswell. What days, Jesse?
Actually, I'm going to leave here in Montana on the 1st of July, and I'll be coming back home on the 5th of July. So I'll be down there 4 or 5 days.
Very good. Well, all of you who are headed to Roswell will get a chance to shake the hand of a man who held pieces of an extraterrestrial, well, I guess we could call it an aircraft, because it was in the air, and it was, at any rate, it was a ship, and it was one of many. They've identified, as you know now, nearly 100 purported crash sites around the world. That's a lot.
Yeah, well, you know, I think a lot of these are just probes that are disposable, because how could they fly light years through space and be dropping like flies out of the skies of our planet here?
I agree. That makes perfect sense.
But I think these are just exploratory probes like we're sending out ourselves.
I agree. Noe, anything you want to add?
Well, I want to say, Jeff, that one of the most remarkable and most enlightening things about going to Roswell during the annual festival over the 4th of July weekend is meeting folks like Colonel Marcel. One of the prized possessions in my library here at home is a first edition of Colonel Marcel's book, The Roswell Legacy, which I want to put in a plug for this. This is the most fascinating book that I've read about the whole Roswell experience that Colonel wrote a couple of years ago with a foreword by Stan Friedman. So these are the sort of treasures that you can pick up, as well as some very interesting thoughts and comments from the Colonel and others who have experienced this phenomenon. So I want to invite all your listeners to make an effort to, if they can't make it to this year's event, the annual Roswell Festival every 4th of July weekend is a fascinating place, a fascinating event.
Indeed.
Thank you for your kind words there.
Anything you want to leave us with tonight by way of final statement here, Jesse?
Well, I guess the message I would like to get over is that we're not alone, that as far as we know, our visitors do not seem to be have a bad connotation. I don't think they're here malevolently, but even the Pope has said that, look, belief in extraterrestrial life should not interfere with your belief in God.
Very good.
Exactly right.
Yeah, sure. Makes a lot of sense. Thank you. It's great to have you on the program again. It's been a long time, but I very much appreciate you getting up late here, staying up late, and sharing your story for the 1,001st time.
Yeah, it's fun. I appreciate the opportunity.
Sure. Thanks a lot,
Jesse. And you too, Noah. Thank you very much for
Thank you. Good night, Colonel.
Okay.
Yes,
care.
Sir. Thanks to all. And
indeed.
We'll be seeing in Roswell, perhaps.
See you in Roswell.
Okay, no. All right. Well, that's quite a man. And again, called up, he's not in his 20s, called up to go serve in Iraq, and he said, yeah, I'll be right there to help. And he went over there. I guess he was there for, a year? I don't know. He was there for quite a while. Doctor helping, trauma units and all that. So he's a real great American, just like his dad. Thank you, Noe, for making that available.
Well, it was a fantastic experience to listen to the Colonel. Thank you for having us on. Yes.
Oh, of course. Well, we got about 5 minutes until the break here at the top, and we're going to come back next hour with you and someone we have not had on the program before, E.J. Wilson. And there's a lot to be talked about with him in terms of what's going to go on at Roswell. What is your connection with E.J.?
Well, EJ is just a fascinating guy. He's worked at the Roswell UFO Museum for several years. He's got a very interesting background. He's an author in his own right. And he took close to 200 pictures of Roswell for our book, The Ultimate Guide to the Roswell UFO Crash, which was just released a couple months ago. So he experienced firsthand, has experienced firsthand the Roswell Festival and the whole experience. He'll have some unique insights to share with us.
Very good. Roswell itself is still a long way from most anywhere. How do most people get there, Noe? What's the easiest way for people? Did they fly in there?
Actually, you know, American Airlines has just, in the past couple of years, American Airlines has a connecting flight from DFW, Dallas-Fort Worth.
Uh-huh.
And so it's really pretty convenient because you can fly from most anywhere in the country to DFW and then just take a smaller plane that American Airlines runs under its American West label out of DFW.
And
you fly
be.
Right into the same airport where all these interesting developments happened back in 47, actually, because it's the old Roswell Army Airfield.
So the Roswell, yeah, that's interesting. I didn't know that. So the Roswell Airport is the 509th.
A lot of people don't realize that those were the very runways that were used to transport this debris, this UFO debris, these alien bodies in and out of Roswell.
Mm-hmm.
Following the crash, and we can certainly talk more about that. We're going to actually be offering a walking tour of the old Roswell Army Airfield during this UFO festival, and EJ and I and Ruben will be leading people on tours of the facility, of some of the very buildings where these strange happenings occurred back in 47.
Well, as you heard Colonel Marcel say, his dad was ordered to fly, not all necessarily, but certainly a significant amount of the debris to Fort Worth to be examined by the top brass down there. And the information going back and forth between them and the Pentagon must have been amazing.
There was an interesting angle there, Jeff, and we can talk about this in the next hour, but when we were doing the research on Colonel Willingham's encounter, we ran across the person who was the base commander at Carswell Air Force Base in Fort Worth.
At the time?
During the 40s, when the Roswell incident happened.
Uh-huh.
And he intimated to his son, we contacted his son, and his son intimated to us that his dad was very much in the know-how, in the know as to what happened in Roswell in 47. And seemed to have a good fix on the fact that the military had indeed come across extraterrestrial artifacts.
Well, what how much did Dad share with his kid?
His father was a career military guy, had risen to a very high rank, and he was very guarded in his comments. However, he did share. You know, the son told us that. It was very clear in conversing with his dad, even though not a lot of words were said, it was very clear that his dad was in the know about extraterrestrial visitations that the military had become aware of. Apparently, Carswell Air Force Base was a key player in several incidents, including the Roswell 1947 case, also in Willingham's case as well.
Wow, very interesting. All right, well, there's a lot of information out there, and it's quite a search to try and unearth and find it. All right, back in a few minutes with E.J. Wilson and Noe Torres as we continue our third hour, coming up next.